A1. Number 2B.
In the first century after Jesus, there lived in Alexandria a very well-known Greek philosopher, a Christian Greek philosopher called Philo, and he interprets really the Word of God as the rational principle in the divine nature, which renders an expression of the divine thought an objective reality. That's very interesting. You see, he says, what is the Word of God? What is the Logos? He says, it's a rational principle in the divine nature. He says, the divine nature has a rational principle. And this divine nature, which has a rational principle, renders an expression of the divine thought an objective reality. It says that God declares himself as what he is. He doesn't declare himself as what we think he may be. We always have our own concept of God, whereas we should have God's concept of God. Our concept of God is of no use at all. We only get then many, many gods. That's all what we get. But what is important and of interest is to learn to know God's concept of himself. And that's the Logos. The interpretation of God as what he is the Logos. Hastings' dictionary says that the Logos in the Old Testament was the declaration or revelation of the divine will. See, again, that's very good. It says, God has divine will. He wants to express his own nature. And the way God expresses himself through his own nature, that's the Word of God. That is called the Logos. The Logos. Now, the first big declaration of this Logos is in the first record of creation, where, as I said before, God declares himself as what he is through seven offices, through the 7 days of creation. You may ask, why seven? My answer is, I don't know. I just don't know. And a further answer may be, I don't care. Because we must just see that this is one of the simplest denominators through which God can be defined. You see, they had this enormous problem that they felt there is a divine principle of the universe expressing itself infinitely. And so they felt, but how can I explain an infinite expression? I would have to be as big as infinity in order to express infinitude. So what they did was something very, very big, something very scientific, that they said, all right, I reduce the infinite to the most fundamental factors in being. And so they could reason out things and could find that they could reduce it to seven fundamental factors. And that by reducing it to those seven, and not to six, and not to eight, but just seven now, because they saw that in those seven they could depict the office of God in its wholeness, that they just came to seven fundamental factors. Just as you could ask me why do you reduce infinite calculation to a decimal system? We can also use a system which is not built on the tenth, just as English money or mileage or many other measurements are not reduced to the decimal system. There is no use why they shouldn't, or there is no reason why it must be the decimal system. You can reduce a subject, an infinite subject, practically to any system. But one always tries to reduce it to that system which is most practical, most the simplest of it. And the thinkers of the Old Testament could see that the simplest and denominator would be the seven. And therefore this number seven goes right through the Bible as a symbol of perfection, as a symbol of holiness. It's a holy number. It's the holiest number we have in the Bible. And so whenever they wanted to depict God in his holiness and wholeness, they would show it through the symbol of the seven. But let me state it right here that it is a symbol and that this has nothing to do with numerology. Numerology is a belief that a number has a mystical force and a mystical power and operation in itself. That's numerology. But that has nothing to do with the use of numbers as symbols. The number by itself has no power, doesn't mean a thing. It only symbolizes something, namely here, holiness. And I mean, if you go through the Bible, you meet this symbol seven over and over and over, especially in the Revelation of St. John. You know how he talks about the seven branch candlestick, the seven stars, the seven churches, the seven angels, the seven trumpets, the seven plagues, seven golden candlesticks, the seven spirits of God, the seven lamps, the seven seals, the seven horns, the seven eyes, the seven trumpets, the seven thunders, the seven heads, the seven kings, and the seven vials. See, that's only out of Revelation, quite apart from the seven, how it appears through all the Bible, just showing how for these rites, the seven was a symbol of the highest magnitude, of perfection, of holiness. Now, Mrs. Eddy, as I have indicated before, took over that same symbolism and that same method. She asks the question in the chapter recapitulation in the textbook, what is God? Again, the inquest into the nature of the one God. And she answers the question, what is God, through a sevenfold statement, by saying God is, first she says, incorporeal, divine, supreme, infinite, and then gives seven names for God: mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love. She gives seven names for God. She does the same as the writer of Genesis did with the 7 days of creation. So really we could say that if we understand the seven synonymous term for God, that then afterwards the term God becomes obsolete. And I think it would be one of the best things if the term God would become obsolete. Because G-O-D just doesn't mean very much. But the moment we answer the question, what is God, through mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth and love, then these seven terms mean already something very, very much more definite. Very much more definite. But it doesn't yet answer everything. Because even when we say God is mind, or spirit, or soul, or principle, or life, or truth, and love, we may have various concepts of what mind is, of what spirit is, of what soul is, of what principle is, or life, or truth, and love. We haven't yet defined God clear enough. So in order to do that, Mrs. Eddy goes on and asks a second question and says, are these terms synonymous? Are these seven terms synonymous? Now, what does synonymous mean? And I must take here the definition of the word synonymous, because the general feeling, which is not the right feeling, the general feeling is that synonymous terms are identical terms, and therefore interchangeable in an unlimited way. But that's not so. Synonymous means something very different, synonymous terms very different than identical terms. And therefore these synonymous terms are not freely interchangeable. So let us first see the definition of synonymous. Funken-Wagnall dictionary has this definition, and this is a very interesting one. He says, by synonymous words, we usually understand words that coincide or nearly coincide in some part of their meaning. See, it only says in some part of their meaning they coincide. Not in all parts, only in some part of their meaning. And may hence, within certain limits, be used interchangeably. So they can only be used interchangeably within certain limits. Only there where in some part of their meaning they coincide. And then the definition makes a comma. While outside of these limits, they may differ very greatly in meaning and in use. So outside of some limits, these synonymous words differ in greatly even in meaning and use. Well, therefore, I think what we really have to ask ourselves now is, within which limits, therefore, are these terms interchangeable? And where are the limits where they are no more interchangeable? Where they greatly differ in meaning and use? And with this question, we really come to the great study of the synonymous terms. So, first, now, let's see first that it is clearly stated, you see, that they are not identical terms. If the seven synonymous terms for God would be identical terms, then they could be used interchangeably. But then we would ask ourselves, why seven terms instead of one? Why make things complicated if we can have it easier and simpler? But because they are not identical terms, because they differ greatly in meaning and use, we have to investigate in which way they are interchangeable and in which way they are not interchangeable. The answer which Mrs. Eddy gives to this question, are these terms synonymous, give us a key to this question. She says, are these terms synonymous? And the answer is, they are. These seven terms are synonymous terms. Then, she says, they refer to one absolute God. This is what they have in common. That's now the limit within which they are interchangeable. Namely, that they all refer to the one absolute God. They all refer to God. Insofar, they are interchangeable. But then, she indicates in which way they are no more freely interchangeable. She says, they are also intended to express the nature, essence, and wholeness of deity. They are intended to express something, to express the nature, essence, and wholeness of deity. Which means that each of those synonymous terms express an office or a nature or an essence of God in a different way than the other synonymous term. That mind expresses God in another way than spirit. That spirit expresses God and defines God in another way than soul, or principle, or life, or truth, or love. See, the moment we come to the question, what qualities, what ideas are meant and are expressed by each of the synonymous terms, we come to the difference between them. That's where they greatly differ in meaning and use. This is as he says, right afterwards, the attributes of God are justice, mercy, wisdom, goodness, and so on. See, now you get the variety of qualities. So, each of the synonymous terms, therefore, express God in a different way than the other synonymous terms. Let me repeat it again, just to get hold of it. In which way do these synonymous terms coincide? When do they coincide? It says they refer all to one God. Therefore, I can say God is mind. But with the same right, I can say God is spirit. I can say, God is soul, God is principle, God is life, God is truth, God is love. Because they all refer to God, I can therefore make those seven statements. I mean always God. I don't mean anything else. Or, if I put the pronunciation different, I can say these synonymous terms are freely interchangeable insofar as they refer to God, because God is spirit, is mind. God is spirit. God is really soul. God is the principle. God is life. See, God is truth. God is love. I always refer to God, meaning that nothing besides God is mind, is spirit, is soul, is a principle, is life, is truth, or is love. In so far, they are interchangeable. But where do they differ? They differ when the nature of God is defined. Not God itself, but the way God expresses itself. When I am interested to know what are the qualities of God, what are the ideas of God. Is there just one idea of God? No, there are infinite ideas of God. There is an infinite variety of the ideas of God. Then they are no more interchangeable, because mind expresses ideas which are characteristic for mind and differ from spirit. Spirit characterizes God in a different way than mind or than soul. Life, for instance, characterizes God in a very different way than perhaps principle or love. And so the great investigation we have to make one day, not in this class, but one day, is to ask, what are these ideas which characterize mind? What are the qualities which really characterize mind? What are the qualities which characterize spirit? And they must be different qualities which characterize spirit. What are the qualities which characterize soul? And again, they are very different qualities, very different ideas, very different values that characterize God as soul than those qualities which characterize God as principle, or as life, or as truth, or as love. So in this way, we come to an infinite range, really, of ideas of God. You see, it's something similar as with the prism. First, we said, we take the white light and let it pass through a crystal prism or a glass prism. And then this white light is resolved into lots of color. We were only speaking about the seven fundamental colors. But as a matter of fact, there are not seven colors. As a matter of fact, there are a whole range of shadings of colors. We have not only one blue, but we have a dozen, hundreds of blues. We have not only one red, we have dozens of reds. Not only one yellow, we have dozens of yellows. Well, take, instead of the white light, take God, the term God. And if we analyze it, we have first a statement of the seven, as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. But mind again, like red has dozens of reds. So mind has dozens of ideas of mind. Dozens of shadings of what mind means. Spirit has dozens of shadings what spirit means. These shadings we call the idea. The ideas of mind, the ideas of spirit, the ideas of soul, the ideas of principle, the idea of life, of truth, and of love. And you see what happens is that through such a wonderful analysis, we reach an infinite range of divine ideas, which are innate, so to say, in God, which belong to God, and yet they are ordered. Just as a blue can be clearly distinguished from red, or a yellow from a green, clearly be distinguished, so will we be able to distinguish clearly God as mind from God as spirit, and from God as soul, and from God as principle, and life, and truth, and love. You may ask me at this moment, what's the use of it? Well, I don't want to answer this question now. Before I can answer this question, we must go on in this class for quite a while. But then I will come back to it. And you will see why we have to understand them if we want to practice the ideas of God. For the moment, I want just to reason this line of deduction further. You see, if you take Mrs. Eddy's text and the definition of God, you find something extraordinary, namely that these seven terms, synonymous terms, are capitalized. Though they are nouns, Mrs. Eddy writes them with capital letters. Why? Because they refer to God, because they stand for the term God. And the term God, I think mostly in the English literature, is written with a capital G. Thus showing that these terms mean a divine being, therefore mean a divine nature, and not a human nature, not an ordinary material or physical or mental nature. The moment I write about God's many, I don't capitalize anymore God, because it's no more the divine being. And in the same way, we will find in the text, and this is very important to notice, in the text of the textbook, we'll find that these seven synonymous terms When they refer to God, they are capitalized. But the moment they do not refer to God, they are not capitalized, are written quite ordinary as the English language would write them. Now most people don't give enough attention to this, and therefore fall into many, many mistakes in reasoning things out. Because the text will show mind with a capital M, but very often will show mind with a small m. And so with spirit, with a capital S, spirit with a small s. So with soul, with principle, with life, with truth, and with love. What is the reason for it? To repeat it again. The reason is that when Mrs. Eddy writes something about the nature of God, and means to depict what God is and does and has and how he expresses himself, that then these terms are capitalized and must therefore be understood only in the divine meaning and never in the human meaning. When these terms are used without a capital letter, they are used in the human meaning and not in the divine meaning. And we shouldn't mix them, or things don't make any sense anymore in the textbook. Let me just take a few examples. We speak about the divine mind capitalized, and mean by it, really, the divine intelligence, the creative divine intelligence. But so often, the text will speak just about mind with a small m. Meaning what? Not the divine creative intelligence, but then it meant the human intelligence, the human way of reasoning things, the human way of looking at things. Or let us take spirit. No, I think I stop here. Let us just stop here. Huh?